Buckle up. It's time for the Champions of Cinema podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Champions of Cinema podcast. My name's Joe Walker. I am one of your hosts. And today I'm joined by my good friend, James. James.
Hello.
What's been going on for you recently?
Not a lot. Just a lot of coursework at the moment. Towards the end now of my student journey. Recently watching the finale of The Boys came out last week.
Very interesting. Yeah, exciting
stuff. As well as a new Ravens documentary finally made its way to NFL Game Pass. So thoroughly enjoyed that. But I'm looking forward to today's episode, Joe.
I am also looking forward to today's episode. And really just thinking about you finishing off your master's. Ready to join the corporate world.
Oh, yes.
Go off to be an executive in a grey suit as we discuss this week's movie, 1975's Rollerball. It's not a biography. It is a completely made-up story. Tell us about this movie, James. What is this movie about?
Rollerball is a dystopian science fiction film originally released in 1975 by director Norman Jewison, based on a short story by William Harrison, Rollerball Murder. So I suppose Rollerball, slightly friendlier name, kind of indicates the sport more. The story is set in a future where corporations have replaced countries as the ruling entities and the world is largely controlled through corporate power. In this future society, the most popular sport is rollerball, a sport mixing roller derby, American football and motorcycle racing played in a circular arena where players on roller skates and motorcycles vie for control of a steel ball, aiming to score points by shooting it into a magnetic goal. The film focuses on Jonathan E, played by James Caan, a star player for the Houston team. As Jonathan's success in the game begins to elevate his personal status and influence, the corporate leaders see him as a threat to their control. They attempt to force him into retirement. Jonathan resists, fighting not only to stay in the game, but also to uncover the truth behind the sinister motives of the corporate elites who control every aspect of society.
Fantastic. Oh, this for me is almost sports movie perfection because it's not just a sports movie.
It's not.
It's a dystopian future sci-fi movie. Mm-hmm. Which, I don't know, I think I've grown up on quite a lot of those kinds of movies, right? So I've spent a lot of my young moviegoer life watching things like A Clockwork Orange, which Jewison actually said massively influenced him in directing and making this movie. So we have a movie with Rollerball in something where they use a lot of classical music, like in A Clockwork Orange. There's a lot of brutalist architecture, like in A Clockwork Orange.
Yes, there is, yeah.
These two movies could almost exist in the same universe. It's a very interesting look, very 70s look at what the future would be like. Yeah, super synopsis. Really like that. Have you got your weekly haiku for us?
I do. Yeah, this is a good one. All right, ready?
Okay, yeah.
Steel ball in the ring. Corporations rule the world. Freedom's fight starts now.
Oh, okay. I really like that.
Yeah.
So you've described what Rollerball is about, a steel ball within the ring. The corporations in control. Oh, and then
Freedom's fight starts now.
You know. Breaking down this movie when we talk about it, is this the beginning of something different for the people of this dystopian alternative world?
That's the thing. I think it could have been. I get a lot of Hunger Games feelings from this in terms of having that kind of divisive figure, anti-establishment there. You know, you can imagine if there was a second film that continued straight on from this, delve deeper into that world, and then, like Hunger Games, distances itself from the actual Hunger Games itself and into more about challenging the hierarchy and stuff. And you can kind of see how maybe some future films would carry on from this. The film was just meant to kind of send a message. You know, it wasn't meant to be a continuing money-making thing. Newsom just wanted to do it, you know, highlight the issues with corporatism and the rising powers that corporate America was having.
Yes, and let's come back to that a little bit later on. What we're going to do now is we're going to talk through, sort of scene by scene, what happens in this movie. I'm going to talk you through it, and let's see if there's anything here that's sort of jumps out to us as interesting or exciting, and see what you think, James. So the film opens with the start of the first rollerball game. We are introduced to Jonathan E and his friend Moon Pie as they win against Madrid. Straight into the action.
It's a great intro. It's a fantastic intro. Yeah, it's just like, I know now instantly what this game's about. I know how it works. You know, they do a very good job to kind of highlight the dynamics of it when it's like the introduction of the bikes and things that come in to, you know, it's fantastic. It's almost like a future version of Quidditch, you know, just that's what I'm thinking of. It's like, imagine Quidditch but violent. You're seeing everyone's all kitted out in their helmets and spiked gloves and pads, and it's just
I think I've read somewhere that this was one of
J.K. Rowling's inspirations.
J.K. Rowling's favourite movies. Oh, I think this is
inspire it then, yeah.
I honestly do think I've read that somewhere, that she loved this movie. I wouldn't be surprised, because I'm pretty sure that in those Harry Potter movies, the Quidditch games are meant to be much more violent than they're shown.
It was kind of like their version of rugby, wasn't it? It was kind of like, you know, there has to be some, there's always a bit of contact and a bit of hustling and that element of danger, yeah.
And something that's you've made a really good point of is, through showing you the game, they show you how the game works. Mm-hmm. And all you're getting really is the visuals of Jonathan and Moon Pie skating around, but you're given the rules by the commentator of the game. Right, mm-hmm. You are given the information about how the game works by the commentary person. And actually, Jewison said that he wanted to have a commentator throughout all of the games so that you could understand what was happening really quickly. And he went through a few different like announcers and found that the only person that he could get to who was quick enough with the information, quick enough with the accuracy of the information, were ice hockey commentators, because they were so used to giving them that, that level of information and also covering the sort of the violence of the movie. So another sort of nod there. But whilst rollerball isn't a real sport, it has a lot of real elements to what we now see from everyday sport, commentary, people explaining things. You know, if you're new to a sport, that we have both been new to a sport in the past, the first time we watch, you know, being British guys, the first time we watch American football, or the first time we watch baseball or ice hockey, you're struggling to pick up that game unless somebody is giving you some baseline information about how that game works. So that's really positive about this.
And it feels like you're watching maybe a real game. You know, it's like, because there's no dialogue in terms of the actual actors, it's just the commentator. It's like, I could very well be watching an actual game between Houston and Madrid playing rollerball, you know. And it's like, and this repeats itself during the film. I think, yeah, as an intro to introduce us to the sport, it's a great start.
Absolutely. So, triumphant in the locker room, our antagonist, Mr. Bartholomew, congratulates Jonathan and Houston. We hear that Jonathan is the best rollerballer of all time, and they are set for another championship. Mr. Bartholomew, kind of creepy and eerie, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He seems like an interesting guy, and he congratulates, and he's very positive, but you get this feeling that he is going to be sort of scary and in control of what's going on.
Have they gone for the Star Wars sort of angle of, let's give the evil dodgy guys British accents? You know how in Star Wars, all the Empire guy, all the guys from the Empire, they all have British accents, but all the rebels are Americans. I think that was a deliberate thing that George Lucas did, and I think there's a similar thing here, where all the corporate people are like, oh, hello, nice to meet you. Oh, Jonathan, superb game today, blah, blah, blah. It's like, there's a kind of, I think, because given that most of the audience will be Americans, having that kind of British accent is sort of unsettling to them, I think.
Well, and they wear grey.
They wear grey.
Like the officers in Star Wars. And you said Mr. Bartholomew's like second in command was in Star Wars?
Was in Star Wars, that's right.
Isn't he the guy who tells Darth Vader that his sorcerous tricks won't work here?
Yes, exactly. Like, I say, your old magic blah 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 ends up getting friendly choked by Vader at some point. Yes, same actor in both of those films. So there's definitely, I'd like to think that, which came out first? This came out in 1975?
Yes.
So this was just 2 years before Star Wars.
Yeah, so it's quite comfortably referred to as the pre-Star Wars sci-fi movies that are the example of what Star Wars made. And there's everything that's made post-Star Wars is very Star Warsy. Everything that's made pre-Star Wars is very pre-Star Warsy, which doesn't make much sense when I say it, but they are very different types of movies, pre and post. So yeah, and I think you're right. There is a desire and an idea to have British accent bad guys that are different to the Americans, because it's for an American audience, right? We know we're the bad guys. We're meant to be the bad guys.
It's that kind of idea of us and them. Right, it's kind of like the corporates are here, they're so much different, better than you, quote, and then everyone else is down there, everyone else is different. So yeah, I think that was definitely a deliberate decision.
And there's only one movie series, I think, where that's different, and that is the James Bond series, which is clearly a British institution where the British guys are the good guys, and the bad guys usually have American accents, right?
Yeah, that's true.
Mr. Bartholomew invites Jonathan to meet him where he is told it is time to retire and record a TV special to announce that retirement. This is something that we just don't necessarily see in the world of sport these days, but
no.
I wouldn't be surprised if you get similar HR meetings in our careers at some point where we're told, maybe this is time, it's time for us to part ways. We're going to future endeavours you and move on to somebody else.
Right. It's not totally an independent decision. It's one that you've been kind of guided into. I mean, just now on the news, we've heard about Biden being told, he's decided that it's time in the interest of the party to step down. But we know that he's had people around him now for weeks telling him, look, I think you've served your country, you've done well, but I think it's time to have a younger person with a bit more energy to take over now. And he said it was just a couple of weeks ago, it would take an act of God for me to step down. Well, maybe that's quite interesting. Just a couple of weeks later, but yes, it's like...
I love that comparison of Jonathan Ian and Joe Biden. Where I think maybe James Caan and Joe Biden are about the same age now. I don't know. Or they would be if James Caan wasn't dead.
You're right. Sounds about right.
But yeah, I can imagine Joe Biden cycling around skating around a rollerball rink, defiantly saying, "I'm just gonna four more years." That's what we're going for here.
Joe Biden probably thinks rollerball's a real sport, actually, and that actually happened in 2018.
So Jonathan starts questioning who this decision is being made by and why, as he looks for answers at the library, being told that books are available on the computer and but pre-edited. He considers his wife Ella, who's been taken by an executive to be their wife and out of his life. So looking back at some old videos, checking on what would be the equivalent of his 1970s phone, looking at his old memories and having his phone tell him, hey, 8 years ago today, you were married with a wife and really happy. And watching back his videos.
Mm-hmm. Oh, thanks, phone. Yeah.
Yeah, screw you, phone. This is no good at all.
Brilliant.
But also, interestingly, that all of the information and knowledge is being put onto a computerized system and held by a world computer. Not the internet at all, James. This is definitely not the internet.
No.
And it's not being edited by the internet either.
No.
And there's no question of whether or not we're going to be losing any knowledge or information from all this uploading at all.
No, it's all good. All good. No, hundreds of years of history being lost here.
No, not in the slightest. We're going to completely avoid that.
No.
So, visited by Cletus, Jonathan's former coach and now an executive for Energy, more questions are asked. Cletus promises to find out more information from people inside of the Energy. We find out here that Jonathan's got a mentor, he's got a friend, and, Cletus used to play rollerball, used to coach rollerball at least, and Jonathan's unsure about everything. Cletus mentions whatever happened to Indianapolis, whatever happened to that city, met by this question of, actually, what is happening to all of these other places in the world? Corporations run the cities. They're all based at certain cities. Houston is the energy city. Chicago is the food city. All of these different places. And they've all got rollerball teams. But what we're not really told about is what's happening in the greater and wider world, which is quite interesting. Jonathan's concubine, Mackie, is replaced by Energy. He refuses to perform his retirement speech, and Mr. Bartholomew is angered. The corporations choose to change the rules of rollerball to make it more dangerous. So we're starting to push Jonathan out here. He's not playing by the rules. He's not doing what he's told. He is not following what Energy and the corporations want. He's becoming a little bit too autonomous.
And, I guess you'd wonder, I think what's interesting about the film is that you'd think, well, why don't they, all these corporates, why don't they just, take his head off? Why don't they just assassinate him or get rid of him like that? But you realize that the whole point of the game is to undermine the human character. So Jonathan needs to fail in the game as opposed to just quietly getting rid of him otherwise, because then you're almost martyring him if you actually kill him. Whereas if you make the game harder and make it so he has, he ends up failing and he can't overcome it, then it's like the game is working as it should be.
Absolutely. It's sort of scary that they are using the game itself, which is the bread and violence for the masses, as the way to control the people within the game as well. They're just like, yeah, we need to get rid of him. We'll get rid of him.
That's right.
And then we get Gambare Tokyo. Gambare Tokyo. Gambare Tokyo. The great Tokyo game. And in Tokyo, Jonathan survives and Houston win, but at the cost of the life of his friend Moon Pie, who's left in a vegetative state.
That was so heavy, that scene.
Yeah, so we've got this great character in Moon Pie who we don't really know much about apart from he is Jonathan's friend and he looks up to Jonathan and before the Tokyo game says, oh, I just copy what Jonathan does, be the next star. And he's almost being groomed as the next, you know, rollerball kind of champion for energy.
Yes.
However, they don't want anybody to be too big, right? The best thing about Moon Pie is Moon Pie doesn't ask any questions.
No, he happily obliges, yep.
He is a good corporate shill. He is the sort of boy who will just go to a party and sleep with someone's concubine and then come down the stairs and nobody will really notice. Perfect.
He's very content. He's thinking, I could be better off. I could also be worse. So I'm just going to keep playing this game, have fun, and just blindly, you know, sort of ignore the fact that he doesn't really have free will and that his life is kind of, his life is kind of in someone else's hands, but he's kind of okay with that, it seems. So I think there's an interesting contrast when you see him and Jonathan together, where Jonathan's sort of becoming more and more self-aware of like the world he's in, but Moon Pie's like, eh, you know,
we're having fun anyway.
It's kind of fine. This guy's all right. I'm getting a massage. I'm getting a massage here. Like, you know, what's the problem? Like, he doesn't have a conversation ever with Jonathan, I don't think, about retiring or like whatever. I think he's just sort of doing his own thing.
He's an interesting character. And what's really fun about this is, here's some little nods that happen in the movie making magic here, James.
Okay.
Jonathan wears six, right? And that six possibly is a reference to the 1960s sci-fi show The Prisoner. And because The Prisoner was number six, he was known as number six. And he's trying to constantly escape from a world where he doesn't really know what's going on.
Right.
Bit of a nod there. However, Moon Pie wears nine.
The inverse of six.
He is possibly seen as the opposite of Jonathan. Not in necessarily like personality or skills, but in his desire to learn, understand, be more open-minded, and to see what's going on in the wider world. Mm-hmm. He is what corporate want from a rollerball player.
Mm-hmm.
He is passionate, he is powerful, he is exciting to watch, but he is not going to do anything that questions what energy and what the corporations want.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Really interesting. After refusing to pull Moon Pie's plug in the hospital after the game, Jonathan travels to Vienna to visit the archives, met by the librarian, who suggests that when the supercomputer Zero has all the information and history, he isn't really cooperative in giving that information up. We're met by this idea that we've got a librarian who's got all of this information being held in a supercomputer, and when you try to find that information, the computer just sort of says, well, no, energy makes the decisions, or corporations make the decisions. No, you're not going to find out about this. The librarian sort of infers at the fact that they have recently lost the 13th century and all of the information held within that.
No, it's one of my favorites. Not the 13th century. Oh.
Exactly. So, and we're sort of like, well, wait a minute. If that's happened with just the 13th century, which we kind of like, well, that's not kind of very, very important. As the librarian puts it, it was just Dante and some corrupt popes. What we start learning is any century can be removed. The victor does control the history of what the reality was. The history is written by the victorious. And at this point, because we've been through the corporate wars and all this sort of stuff, the corporations are just deciding we're going to write the history and we're going to change the history to whatever we want it to be.
And the thing is, there's a constantly reoccurring phrase that's sort of used whenever someone's trying to find books and stuff in this world. It's like, are there any of the original books around? It's like, oh no, but we have the transcribed versions from that, you know, that you can use and stuff. Because like, you can trust the transcribed versions, and actually we know as the audience that these transcribed ones are going to be heavily edited to kind of suit the agendas of, you know, the corporate ruling class. So
yeah, absolutely. Comrade Stalin has decided that those are perfectly acceptable for you to read.
Absolutely, yeah.
That's the phrase, isn't it? Control the information and you control the people. Is that what they say? I think
100%. Yeah, yeah.
You know, Jonathan's left with this idea that he's really struggling to find any information about how the corporate wars started, who's in control, what's all going on. It is really murky out there. But then Jonathan returns home, where he's met by his ex-wife Ella, who we've seen videos of, but we've never actually met her, who has been sent to make a final plea for him to step away from Rollerball. They make love, and Ella tells him that the final game will be designed to kill him. Jonathan cuts ties with Ella, deletes his memories of her, and steels himself to play the game regardless of the outcome. This man has decided, well, I can't get the information, I can't understand what the system is and why the system's trying to make me quit this game that I love. And whilst it's taken my wife away, it's even tried to send back my wife to try and convince me to quit as the last that ditch effort. And he's just saying, nah, we're going to play anyway. So I'm going to suit up and I'm going to do it. And you just think he's learned that he can't escape from any of this. And actually, what does he want? He just wants to finish off playing the game. He loves the game that much, or he doesn't know anything outside of the game that much, that this is it. This is what he's going to have to do.
I feel like part of what, and you can kind of, some of this is brought out, I think, in his relationship with Moonpie, is that I think he acknowledges the fact that he's towards the end of his career. I think he's kind of grooming Moonpie into the leader role, and he's kind of telling him all the little nuances and secrets and how to run the team and stuff. But I think it's when the ruling class tell him he has to retire, he doesn't like that because he wants to go out on his own terms. You know, he would like to be able to know that this is my decision and that I'm not letting someone else tell me when I've got more left in the tank. And I think that is the most kind of real aspect of this film, is that kind of sense that I've got more left in me. I know I can still play at a very high level, but then equally it's kind of like, when is the time to retire? Because we see so many athletes that were once great, their kind of final year or two not so great, and eventually they decide to retire. But in this game, you're not necessarily allowed to have that position. There's a great quote by Mr. Bartholomew, that a line in the film where he says, this isn't a game you grow into, you know, because of the short life expectancy of the athletes in this deadly game. You know, it's like you don't have that luxury to kind of decline before something really bad happens to you. Jonathan is given this ticket, but he doesn't want to use it because he knows he's still playing at a very high level. So that's the sort of thing I think which you can pull out of this movie and be, this is real. We've seen this before in the sports that we watch today.
100%. Absolutely. And that is really prevalent in what we're seeing towards, as the movie sort of progresses on and on and on, you're sort of like, this is kind of about, really. So, New York, the final game, we see Jonathan met by the faces of his silent teammates in the locker room. They know the situation. They know that death is coming. And there's no rah-rah speech before this final game. There's no question of, you know, let's go out there and win. Everybody knows the score. Everybody knows that this game is designed not only to kill Jonathan, but probably to kill everybody on that Houston team, right? Jonathan looks at his teammates sat either side of the sort of the walkway in the locker room, and I got huge Gladiator vibes of when Maximus Decimus Meridius is about to walk out into the arena for the fight against many different gladiators before he goes off to Rome. And you can just see these people looking at him as if to say, he's going to do it. He's going to go out there and do it on his own. He's going to go out there and, you know, they both in awe of him and silently knowing, well, this is our fate. This is where we're going to go and this is what's going to happen to us. How much is this movie like Gladiator, James? It's a lot like Gladiator. So we've got a gladiatorial sport. We've got a man who is defiant of the system, who he doesn't want to end. He doesn't want to come out of it. He's given opportunities to sort of escape from that world, but he decides, I'm going to stick in with it. Is this close enough that we could see Rollerball just being Gladiator? All right. And I came up with this for you to listen to. I could quite comfortably see Jonathan at some point in this movie turning around and saying to the executives, my name is Jonathan E., husband to a stolen wife, best friend to a vegetable called Moon Pie, and I shall find what happened in the 13th century to Dante and those corrupt popes in this life or the next.
maybe not the 13th century stuff, but I can absolutely can see him saying that, yeah. Or what about what we do in our lives echoes in eternity?
Echoes in the rollerball ring, yeah. whatever comes out of that New York tunnel, we've got to face it together. And somebody says, I played with you at Madrid. And he's like, I'll need you. You know, those kind of things. But it's so true. I see this as I was like watching this back and I was like, there are so many things where you're like, I wonder if Ridley Scott just plucked that out of Rollerball, maybe subconsciously, and just said, I'm going to put that into this movie. I'm going to have, because there's so many things, so many scenes where you're like, yeah, this is exactly the same. Maximus knows that he's not going to make it out of that final fight against Commodus, but can he take the system down at the same time as playing the final game? You know, that's quite interesting for me.
Send a message and stuff.
Jonathan battles through the New York game, crowd chanting, Jonathan, Jonathan, at the same time as the New York crowd is chanting, Jonathan's dead, Jonathan's dead, Jonathan's dead.
Yeah.
Interestingly, I watched that final scene. I was struggling to understand exactly what people were saying. So I turned on the subtitles, which I sometimes do if I'm struggling with a movie a little bit to hear stuff. And it completely changed for me what some of the things that were being said in that final scene. I was like, wait a minute, they are chanting, Jonathan's dead.
Yeah.
Houston come out of the Houston tunnel and they're shouting, Houston, 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 Houston. New York come out of their tunnel and they are chanting, Jonathan's dead, Jonathan's dead. They know what they are there to do, right? It is absolutely insane. But Jonathan survives this contest, right? And finally, with all the foes in the Rollerball Arena vanquished, Jonathan scores a goal and triumphantly skates the aflame Rollerball rink victorious. Cheered on by all the people there, but the executives, we are left with his determined and defiant face in freeze frame, unsure of his final fate. My question for you, James, is what happens to Jonathan after this movie? Is this a start of Hunger Games where Jonathan starts to bring down the corporation system?
Mm.
Or is he quietly dispatched by a mob of bad guys in the locker room after the game?
There's that interesting moment, isn't there, when just as he scores, he's staring at Bartholomew. He's right there on the other side of the barrier. And I think Bartholomew's reaction is maybe the best indicator of that, because he's like, he's not necessarily really angry, Bartholomew. You'd think he's seething. If he was seething, saying, no, don't you dare, Jonathan, don't you dare score that, then maybe it's like, okay. I think, actually, he realizes that he's nothing, he can't really do anything to Jonathan. You can, or it's like, what can you do now? They changed the rules of the game. They said, right, you can't sub off. There are no penalties anymore. I think at this point, Jonathan can maybe now leave, because the game he's enjoyed is he hates now. It's like his whole team is dead now, you know, and it's like, and also that was the last game of the season. I think now he can probably leave and stuff. Now he really has like done it, because, you know, they've won it now, which is exactly what they didn't want. So I think Jonathan's won. He's sort of done it on his own terms. I think now is maybe when you say, I'm done with this game. And now you go into Rollerball 2, which is actually him amassing a rebellion army.
I'm Jonathan. No, Jonathan. I'm Jonathan.
We're a Jonathan.
Spartacus, the rising of the slaves. Yeah, it's actually, I think you're right. I think there are some of those things happening. I wonder whether or not that's the last game of Rollerball that world ever sees.
Mm.
Because it's, in essence, Rollerball has been completed.
Yes.
Done it. Yeah. Completed it, mate. You know, and maybe it would become a bit of a challenging situation. Yes, I think Mr. Bartholomew and the executives have decided that Jonathan needs to be eliminated. However, they know now that if he was to be eliminated, there'd be so many more people turning up at the library in Vienna asking what happened in the 13th century to Dante and those popes, mm-hmm. which everybody knows. We just don't need everybody turning up in Vienna. That's a bad idea.
Mm-hmm.
We need to sort of keep control of what's going on, which is quite interesting. James, as we always do in these episodes, I want you to talk to me about athletes. Who are the athletes in this movie? What is going on here? Who is being played by who? Who are the athletes that we need to know about? And what's kind of special about them?
Well, we obviously know Jonathan E as the main character, James Caan in sports movies before. And this version of James Caan is very different. I think the one from Brian's Song is very much, is very jokey, very kind of witty, lots of banter and stuff. This version is of James Caan is actually quite plain. It's quite vanilla. Doesn't really smile much. I mean, I know there's not a lot to smile about as from his perspective in this movie, but all he sort of knows is to play Rollerball. And that's kind of, I guess, what makes his motivations more sort of understandable, why he ultimately chooses to keep playing, why he chooses to... He asks for his wife back after the corporate executives took her away. Because this film, you know, was made so long ago in the 70s and the pacing of it, it's kind of hard to really psychoanalyze the kind of athlete that Jonathan E. is. However, when you look at how they've sort of laid him out, he's had a long career in a contact sport. He's still playing his best ball despite being much older than the people around him. Questions about him retiring. He chooses to split from his wife just so he can extend his career. This is clearly the Tom Brady of rollerball that we're witnessing right here. Okay. This is Thomas Edward Patrick Brady Jr., no doubt.
He just loves the game, right?
Yeah, he just loves the game. I think it's quite simple in that. I don't think he has too much personality. I don't know if that's deliberate or not, but if anything, having someone like Moon Pie there as the kind of distraction, the kind of witty one, there's that moment when they're preparing for the Tokyo game and they bring someone in to kind of help, you know, say, look, Tokyo are gonna try and do this to you. They're gonna do these sort of attacks on you. And, you know, it's actually Moon Pie being the vocal one on the team, making lots of jokes and stuff, as opposed to, you know, whilst Jonathan's sort of back there in the corner. So if anything, I'd say Jonathan has a more vocal role as a mentor than as a player, which is quite interesting.
Absolutely. I think this is the first time we see player coach happening in sort of, well, you know, we've only covered two movies, James, but this is the first time that we're going to see like a player coach, somebody who is both a player and the mentor to other people within the team.
Yes.
We're going to see that more and more in some of the movies that we cover. Interestingly, during my research, I went away and watched a couple of pre-movie coming out interviews with James Caan, and I was like, okay, at some point he's got to talk about this movie and say how much of a great experience it was making it. It is almost impossible to find James Caan saying anything about this movie. When I've read some little bits, you know, James Caan was originally said, hey, what's this movie about? And his response famously was, it's about 95 minutes. I think even James Caan didn't really know who he was trying to portray during this whole thing. And I think he actually quite dislikes that he wasn't given any opportunity for range or for playing with the character, or for coming up with some ideas. We don't know where Jonathan's from. We don't know anything about his parents, or his background, or his schooling. Whether or not he was just trained to play rollerball from the age of 12. We don't know any of that information. And therefore, it kind of limits us to understanding that the only things that we really need to know about Jonathan is great at rollerball, hasn't got a wife anymore, has got concubines, doesn't really care, all I'm interested in is playing rollerball. It makes him a little bit limited as a character, but that allows, and I think this is a 70s thing about, a thing about some sort of 70s movies that you come across, is it allows you as the viewer to come up with your own ideas about where he's from and how this works.
And the main focus of the film is more about the world that it's set in. Brian's Song was very much a character-driven film. Where actually it didn't really matter what team they're on. It could have been the Chicago Bears, it could have been the Packers, it could have been hockey, it could have been a different sport altogether. It's all about the dynamic between the pairing. Whereas this is very much about the world that they're in and the kind of relationship between the corporate elite and everyone else. So I think there is elements that you can bring out of personality with Jonathan E., but it's far less a part of it due to it being a fictitious story as well, that you can see that maybe James Caan had less to work with. He had a southern accent.
Yeah.
I guess because he's playing for Houston. Because James Caan, I think, is actually Italian, I believe, right? As in, like, Italian-American?
He's an Italian-American, and I believe he was brought up... Actually, I think he was brought up in the Northeast. I think he was brought up in, like, the Boston area.
So, but he definitely has, like, a kind of southern accent when he's talking about... He's probably had less to work with, and maybe at the time didn't fully understand, like, what the film was about as well. There's that clip I've seen where, during the shooting of the film, you know, they're kind of saying, so there's this film being made, blah, 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 it's called Rollerball. That's what it's about, and he sees it much more as it's a film about the sport, explaining how the sport works, the rules of the sport, blah blah blah, when actually the focus is far more about the world that the sport is in.
Absolutely. We'll come back to that in a bit, because I want to talk a little bit about how what Jewison was trying to achieve with the movie in his mind, mm-hmm. and what the movie actually became in the world
sure.
wider when it was released. If we talk about coaches quickly, there really isn't any. No. There are some mentors and some older people. So we can see that Jonathan E, you know, really gets on with Mr. Bartholomew at first. He listens to him. He'll meet with him. He'll go into a room where Mr. Bartholomew is surrounded by very sharp pieces of glass, having to think with his head in his hands. You know, so he sees his life's controlled by this father figure that Mr. Bartholomew is. We don't really have a coach for the Houston team. We do have an executive that runs the team that we see in the background every now and then, and quite an interesting character, has one of the best lines in the whole movie. Game? This was never meant to be a game! Mm-hmm. Which is like really famous, and you know, there's people that care about him, and there's the people that care about the team, but there isn't a formal coach. We do get the specialist coach who comes in to talk about how Tokyo are going to play, but he's immediately shouted down by this Houston team, who are like, we're a power team, we don't care about these, you know, little Japanese guys with their Hong Kong fooey skills. We're not interested in any of that. We're just gonna beat the fuck out of them, in essence, and that's gonna be the way that we do some things. So, you know, when it comes to coach-athlete relationship, you know, something that we almost created this podcast to talk about, there isn't one. There is just really the relationships between people, which are interesting, limited, and actually it brings into question, because we say Cletus was the coach previously, but he's now moved into an executive role with Energy. There's this lack of a coach, I think, in the movie, that maybe I think if we had a coach, it might have done something differently to what the movie was trying to achieve.
It would certainly make it feel more like a sports movie, I think. Kind of missed that. If there was, let's say, a coach who, you know, he's missing an eye, his arm's missing, blah, blah, blah. He's someone which played until the wheels fell off. Listen here, Jonathan, you don't want to turn out like me, okay? Leave the game before the game leaves you. Like, you could, that would, I think, then make it kind of about a sports movie, and we would kind of hint at those, more heavily lean on those themes that we mentioned before, you know.
I don't know why your coach almost sounded a bit Belichickian there. I mean, come on, Jonathan, what are we doing here?
Come on, Jonathan, what are we doing here, man? Like,
goddamn, Houston High could make that play.
you've played for 10 years, Jonathan. Like, pack it in, man.
Love it. We know what the key relationships are. We know what the relationship tropes are. Something I wanted to just touch on really quickly, the concubines in this movie, the women. Okay, so we now live in a modern world where we often have central female characters to a lot of the movies that we see. These female characters are so pushed to the fringes of this movie that whilst Maud Adams is incredibly beautiful, I can see why Jonathan is quite comfortable sleeping with her again when she comes back and then just deletes all his memories of her. We are sort of met with this idea that there is quite a horror aspect going on for some of these people. There's the party that Jonathan goes to where they're supposed to be announcing his retirement. Whilst they're watching the special on the TV, there's a woman outside having what looks like a mental breakdown. And then post that party, in their hangover drunken state, they take a gun outside and start shooting at trees. And even then we see Mackie, Jonathan's old concubine, who's now with somebody different, is, you know, shooting these trees, clearly in some sort of an inebriated state. But you can see her having a moment of crisis too. There is a lot of crisis going on for these people, but they also know that they are stuck in this environment. They are stuck in this world where men control it, corporations control it, and, you know, they are purely there for the pleasure of the men that are involved in the movie.
No, they're completely objectified. You know, they're almost like contracted wives, essentially.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like, right, you're with him now.
For 6 months.
A six-month contract.
And he won't get attached. You know, we're not going to give you long enough to get attached to him. He is purely there for your enjoyment. And we talk about Jonathan's wife, Ella. In some ways, we're like, well, she was taken by an executive. But in other ways, we hear that she left because Jonathan was married to the game. And, you know, we've got that questionable inference of, was she taken? Did she go? You know, what is she doing now? She's living this great life with an executive in Rome. And, you know, Jonathan is, you know, pining for her as the only thing he ever wanted outside of Rollerball. An interesting phrase that he uses.
It's kind of, there's that, I think you're right. It's like, whilst you're thinking about the time frame, new system can take hundreds of years to take place, but actually this only takes place in 2018. This is less than 50 years after the film actually came out. So really, you can imagine that there's still a little bit of resistance towards the new order. So that's why during the film, we see these little tablets being handed around to everyone, which I suppose are the kind of equivalent of lewds. These things just to sort of dumb you down, kind of like make you more docile, you know. It's kind of like, and they're just handed without question, like, what's this? Oh, I'll just have it, maybe you'd be fine, you know. It's kind of like there's that element of these girls are trapped and they're in crisis, but they're just sort of like, they can't pick the man of their dreams, they're just sort of along for the ride.
This is, again, slavery, the gladiatorial aspect. Yes, we have the gladiator rollerball players who are there for the entertainment of the executives and the masses, and they are serviced and provided by the energy corporation with women. Mm-hmm. You know, those women are there purely a form of slavery, which is incredibly scary.
Mm-hmm. No, you're right.
So, a great question for us here. You know, James, is this a hero's journey?
It's a chapter of a hero's journey. I think it's a section of it. It's like we get a glimpse towards the end of our hero's journey. There's so much has happened before this film, clearly, to kind of get to where it is now in terms of creation of the world that we see, in terms of the long career Jonathan's already had, which we're just oh look, you know, Jonathan, you've had a great 10-year career. We don't have anything to look back for. How well has he done? How many championships has he won? How many games has he won? How much has he overcome? I mean, how many teammates has he lost? Like, how lucky is, how much of a unicorn event is his career that the corporates have had to step in to say, look, this can't go any further because this is just defeats the whole point of it. It's part of the hero's journey, and I think, like, because the film is so focused purely on the story of the world that it's set in and the meaning behind it, we were kind of deprived of a more rounded, more complete character arc. I think there's a lot to be taken out that can be pointed and compared to stuff that we see in athletes today.
True. There isn't a full arc for this character, apart from his awakening, mm-hmm. as you might call it, to understanding what's going on. And that awakening is purely pushed by his being told that he can't do the thing he wants to do anymore. Mm-hmm. He starts going, well, why? I don't understand why. I don't think before that he would have questioned any of it. He would have just been like, boom, 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 this is what I do. I go through life. Every now and then I'm going to ride my horse and watch some videos of my ex-wife and listen to some beautiful classical music at the same time that's sad. There isn't much going on there. It doesn't conform to any of those classic story scripts that we understand, right? It's not going to play along like that. So if you're looking for a movie that's going to give you some inferences to, here's a start, here's a middle, here's an end, it doesn't do mm-hmm. it. It sort of questions all of that for you, which can make it feel a little bit broken, unfortunately, because it doesn't give you a full outcome. It makes you go, well, abruptly ended. I didn't really get any closure. But I think that's a little bit indicative of the time period that it was made in.
That's true, yeah.
You know, we do get some growth in Jonathan. We do get some understanding. He moves on, pushes things aside. He starts saying, well, I'm done with that. He draws a line under his old life and says, well, I'm going to either die on the rollerball rink or I'm going to come through to the other side of it, which is quite interesting. That question of, with any sports movie, do they win? Well, yeah, Jonathan does win, but only Jonathan wins. Nobody else survives. Nobody else makes it through that game. Everybody on Houston is dead. Everybody on New York is dead. You know, the only people that were left with are the executives, the fans. Jonathan's skating around the rink. Yes, he does win, but there's no lifting a trophy moment. There's no being triumphant. The only triumphantness we get is the defiance skating around the rollerball rink at the end.
It's a bittersweet victory, I suppose.
And the only reason we think really that Jonathan wins is because he's more determined and violent than anybody. I think what we see in Jonathan is, you know, he's killing people for entertainment. He's just like, this guy needs to go. He's standing between me and my success or my survival in this game. Is this really a sports movie? Is it art or is it entertainment? Jewison was making a movie with social commentary, talking about the corporations taking more and more power, sport and entertainment just being there for the distraction of the masses. It was meant to make people feel sick, uneasy, and scared about the future coming for them. The reality was, Americans just loved the action and violence. Yes, it was produced by Norman Jewison, written by William Harrison with that short story in Esquire, Rollerball Murder, originally, you know, designed for and rewritten for the screen. This movie was made on a $6 million budget and made $30 million. It was actually quite a big hit of its time, you know, making five times its budget. We think about this, it's breaking quite a lot of new ground when it comes to movies of those times. It was filmed a lot in Munich in Germany. You know, you use the BMW headquarters as the energy headquarters, the BMW museum being the library that Jonathan goes to. The rollerball arena was specifically built for this movie in the local basketball arena that had been used for the Olympics. Made the game of rollerball fully and wrote out the rules fully. You can find those rules on the internet and you can read exactly how rollerball is played. The scary thing about that is multiple people tried to buy the rights for the game of Rollerball to make it into a real sport. Jewison making a movie about social commentary and saying, this is how violent and horrible this thing is. Americans, let's make Rollerball a real thing.
I think this film kind of experiences the same misinterpretations as Born in the USA by Bruce Springsteen. I think when you listen to that song, Born in the USA, it's kind of like, you think, oh, this is like a really patriotic song. This is great. You know, it's kind of like, you see it being used in films. When actually, when you look at the lyrics of that song, it's not patriotic at all. It's about the Vietnam War. It's about the kind of the military industrial complex. If anything, it's a critique of America. It's not being glamorous at all. This film is the same. The film was made to show the sickness and insanity of contact sports and their allure, as he was said. Europeans understood this message, but of course the Americans that made up most of the audience seemed to miss this negative reflection. I think it was great that Jewison managed to hold on to the rights, because if he had given those up, I think we would have lost Rollerball's initial message if we did see like a less violent version of Rollerball actually hit our television screens on a regular basis.
And actually, I don't want to watch Rollerball as a game. I don't think it's necessarily the best game in the world. It's got some interesting ideas, and it was such an enjoyable game to play that the stuntmen and the cast were actually playing it between takes on set during the making of the movie.
Amazing. The stuntmen had actual movie credits, didn't they?
Very first movie where stuntmen got credits, which is, you know, world-breaking a little bit, kind of earth-shattering.
100%.
They were such a huge part of this movie. When we look at how the movie's shot, when we look at how it's made, those shots of the sport are there to make you actually think, I'm really watching the sport here.
It's real. People are really falling off their bikes. They're really getting thrown to the ground. It's like, there's nothing which makes you feel, oh, that's a bit silly. Like, that's a bit slapstick. Like, it's real. You know, they did such a good job of it. And I think it's great that the stuntmen, who, as far as I'm aware, no one got seriously hurt or killed during the making of this movie. And I think it's great that they managed to get a reference.
Yeah, so actually, there was a big rumour for a long time that stuntmen died in the making of this movie. Now, was that to try and push the interest level from the Americans?
Could be.
Just makes people want to go and watch those stunts a little bit more, I think. It makes people look at them and go, wow, was that where somebody died? Was that where somebody got in some trouble? But no, we do know that people did get seriously injured playing Rollerball during the making of the movie. We do know that there was quite a lot of challenges. I think James Caan even had some minor injuries during the production of the movie. But it just goes to show, so these kinds of movies are difficult and problematic to make. TikTok, James. Talk to me about your TikTok moment from this movie.
I think it's hard to, because TikTok moments need to be short, and this movie has such long scenes and such long action periods. The one I've gone for as a TikTok moment doesn't even include necessarily the main character of this film, but I've picked the death of Moon Pie.
Oh, okay, interesting, yeah.
As like a TikTok moment. I feel like when you watch the film and the setup towards, you kind of see what's happening before it happens. During the Tokyo game, members of the Tokyo team are kind of waiting on the boundaries. They're looking to see who on the Houston team is sort of by themselves, who's looking vulnerable, and you know, they see Moon Pie sort of trailing at the back, and they jump on him, pin him down, and then they do this, you know, kind of almost like an execution.
It's a coup de grace, I believe.
Is that actually what that is?
I think a coup de grace is when you, the final blow, pow, pow, in the back of the head.
Right in the back of the head, which unfortunately essentially makes Moon Pie brain dead. But there's an awe of irony, of course, because Moon Pie, you know, whilst the team was preparing for the Tokyo game and having that sort of contact with the Tokyo strategy specialist, you know, they were sort of alluded to the fact that they would use these kind of tactics, but Moon Kai sort of shook this off. So for me, like, whilst there were already some deaths during the first game against Madrid, and then there were some already in the Tokyo game, and they signify the deaths with those, every player is represented by these colored lights, and when a player dies, their lights go away. Kind of like, almost like a...
It's an extinguishing of their life and their lights, isn't it? Yeah.
And it kind of dehumanizes them. You kind of don't see these people as characters, but Moon Pie being the first named character to die, that was kind of like a heavy moment in the film, I think. Wow. You kind of realize, like, okay, this game really is far more serious than maybe it tries to. I think it kind of... The deaths don't seem that kind of significant in the start of the movie as much as they did in the Moon Pie one.
And interestingly, the Moon Pie death it's got some harrowing elements to it. There's some concerning thing, you know. But you're also like, well, Moonpie died doing what he loved, right? And then Jonathan's asked to turn off the plug, and he doesn't. He's like, no, I'm going to leave you, you know. And he refers to it. He goes back and visits Moonpie in his, you know, test tube that he's then living in next to his little potted flower. And he says, you know, you're like a god now. You're sort of going to live forever. What he says. It's quite an interesting way of looking at it.
I think another thing with the death thing is kind of major is that, like, this whole time Moonpie has been sort of been brought up to sort of maybe at some point take over the team. He's Jonathan's number two, kind of the next experienced person. But once he goes, it's like Jonathan's like, well, it's just me again. If anything, Moonpie's death forces Jonathan to double down in terms of his involvement with the sport, which I think is, yeah, it's maybe not something which if you watch the scene by itself, you can grasp. But perhaps, you know, I think when that moment comes up, it's like, it's not just a big moment for Moonpie, it's a big moment for Jonathan as well.
I love it. I think it's a really good moment to pick. I don't know if I've got an alternate, but I do really like the scenes between Jonathan and Ella when she comes back to see him, and the deleting of the relationship that he's been watching back again and again. But I do think it's interesting. I also think that the very first scene in the locker room with Mr. Bartholomew visiting the team is so indicative of what we see throughout sports all the time now. Access, where we see, you know, the owners and the head coaches of teams go in and
owners-player relationship,
visiting the players and congratulating them. I think that's really close to what we're seeing in the real world these days. So that was really interesting to me.
Congratulating them, but also kind of patronizing them, kind of being like, you know, I own you. You're on my team now. You know, it's kind of like, yeah, there's some stuff there for sure.
Just going back to deaths, Moonpie's death is bad. But I tell you something, Blue, who was the motorcycle rider for Houston, his death is so much worse.
The catches fire, right?
Blinded by somebody, rides his motorcycle into the edge of the rollerball arena.
Yeah.
Where the motorcycle then blows up and sets him on fire, and he has to burn to death on the track. Moonpie getting punched once in the back of the head. He doesn't really see it even coming.
Paralyzed, yeah.
This guy has one of the most horrific and violent deaths. I always think, actually, I was watching it back and I was like, oh, I wish we'd had a little bit more team character development of the other characters within the Houston team. But I can see why Jewison doesn't do it.
It's kind of his trusty motorcycle guy. I think he was almost tempted to do it because there's that earlier scene with the big guy. I can't remember. The one that tries to, there's like,
Our friend from Manila, Tuffy. Yeah.
Yeah, right. It's kind of like they introduce characters, but at the same time, they don't want to distract you too much from, like, actually then what's more important is the story itself rather than the characters.
So, James, did you enjoy 1975's Rollerball?
Absolutely. I absolutely enjoyed it. I think when you showed me the trailer for this film, I was like, what is this? Like, how did James Caan go from The Godfather, perhaps the greatest movie of all time?
Definitely the greatest movie of all time. We'll come back to that. This will be a recurring theme. Joe's favourite movie of all time, The Godfather. Watched for the first time when I was 8 years old. Absolutely. Although, I'd say, I don't think I really even care that much about James Caan's portrayal of Sonny in that movie. It's great, but he's coming down off of, you know, making the greatest movie ever, which, sure, I suppose when you make it, you don't know you're making it, into, hey, go to Germany and make this game where you're going to have to wear roller skates.
Go wear roller skates and tights, you know. I sort of assumed it was going to be a bit sort of jokey, a bit kind of silly. Kind of in like a Starship Troopers kind of way. You know, if people have watched that film, they know that that's also another film which kind of maybe slightly dated in its sort of design and its visuals, but actually the story of it is very real and is very prevalent.
It's an anti-war film that people see as a
action movie, right? Exactly. I think they both sort of are in similar spheres in that regard, so I think it's absolutely a great film.
A great thing for people to learn throughout your life of either watching movies or any kind of media you consume is, and I always had this argument, I remember having this discussion once with a girlfriend a long time ago. I remember saying, oh, I love this song, Every Breath You Take by The Police. I love how it's about a stalker. And she said to me, oh, I'd never listen to the words of songs, I just listen to the music. I thought to myself, ah, you haven't really understood the point of some of these media formats where somebody's giving you a cautionary tale or an allegory of what this thing is really about. You're hearing the music, and that is the difference of watching these movies at times. You know, Rollerball isn't about watching the violence and the excitement of a futuristic modern sport awesomeness. It's about, are corporations running your life? Is there a bigger sphere of influence happening? Is information being limited to you? And what conspiracy theories would you like to talk about today, James? You know, those kinds of things that are going on. To me, this is an absolutely fantastic movie. It's one of my favourites, not only because it's a 70s sci-fi movie and it's sort of dystopian in its way of looking. It's got Kubrickian ideals. It uses classical music rather than any kind of modern music, so it doesn't date the movie. People say that actually, as pre-Star Wars 70s sci-fi movies go, this is the one that holds up more than anything because it's not overly dated by the set design and the colour and the music that goes on. I think it is absolutely up there in art's sense of, hey, here's a sports movie that really has a sub-theme going through it all the time. A young man will watch this movie and go, wow, violence, excitement, interest. And I actually read something that said that there's a drinking game to this movie, that one of you picks Rollerball and one of you picks Jonathan. And any time that word is said during the movie, you drink. And apparently, if you do that, you don't even get to the Tokyo game. It's impossible to get to the Tokyo game.
That's sort of heavy drinking. Well, I was going to say, well, what would happen during the New York game when the crowd's chanting, Jonathan?
Just like necking, Jonathan. You just got to, I think that's one of those situations where you have to just drink until, it's like drink while you think. You have to continue to drink during the whole chant and you just die. You just die of alcoholism.
You turn into moon pie.
Which brings us round to the final, kind of final thought, really. So, James, is it a champion? Is it a contender? Is it a bit part player? Is it cut in the first sort of stages of its infancy?
I feel like the best parts of this movie are kind of not sporty enough or not really a sports movie. I think it's a great film. I think it's, in terms of the dystopian genre, probably ends up being top 10. Probably in terms of like dystopian future films. But I think in a way, for good reasons, if it really emphasized more on the sports elements of it, it would then not be so good of a dystopian future movie. So as a sports movie, it's certainly not a champion. You know, it's more probably as a kind of a novelty sports movie that we'll look upon. But I still think it's very much a film worth watching and a fun change from maybe the usual sports movies which we watch, you know, all the time.
Yeah, I think this is a challenger. Absolutely. It's one where it'd be somewhere in your movie collection of things that you like. You don't need to watch it again and again and again, even though some of us do. And I will continue to watch this movie. I will return to this movie once every couple of years just to be like, oh yeah, Jonathan.
What's the thing again? The Tokyo.
So the chants by the Tokyo team are Gambare Tokyo, which means do your best Tokyo. Gambare. So they say Gambare.
Currently, if people are listening, me and Joe Gambare, are doing air punching our hands just like the Tokyo fans, because that's a cool scene.
There's 100% going to be coming out some social media posts of that part of the movie where James is just punching at the air saying
Gambare Tokyo. Gambare.
And I will also be getting myself a Jonathan E. orange jersey at some point. Oh,
nice.
just for socials. Bringing this back around, we always say that we want to try and round out each episode with a thoughtful quote. For this week, it's actually a poem, James, for you. So then it made me think about Jonathan's character and his resolve about who he is and who he wants to be. This one's sort of a poem by a guy called Dale Wimbrough Sr., called The Man in the Glass, and I'm going to read that for you now. When you get what you want in your struggle for self, and the world makes you king for a day, just go to the mirror and look at yourself and see what that man has to say. For it isn't your father or mother or wife whose judgment upon you must pass. The fellow whose verdict counts most in your life is the one staring back from the glass. He's the fellow to please, never mind all the rest, for he's with you clear to the end, and you've passed your most difficult, dangerous test if the man in the glass is your friend. You may fool the whole world down the pathway of years and get pats on the back as you pass, but your final reward will be heartache and tears if you've cheated the man in the glass.
What a poem. That's great. Yep.
Yeah. And I think if we were saying this, okay, Jonathan E., he makes it back to that changing room after that game finishes. He gets a moment to look in the mirror.
The man in the glass.
Before whatever's coming for him happens. Is he happy with who the man in the glass is? 100%.
100%.
James, it's been a pleasure to bring Rollerball to your eyes and ears. I hope this one has been great for you.
Absolutely. Yeah, can't wait. Can't wait for the final part of the James Caan trilogy next week. I guess we'll have to wait and see what that film is.
No. James, next week, the newest NCAA game has come out in the last couple of weeks. It is very, very poignant to our lives. It is possibly the greatest college football movie ever made.
Oh my God.
We are going to go and deep dive into 1993's The Program, the movie that made it possible for Oliver Stone to create Any Given Sunday. This is the college version of that movie.
Oh my God, I can't wait.
So, next week, come back and let us regale you with the greatest college football movie that's ever been made, The Program. Looking forward to speaking to you soon. Take care, bye-bye.